Hi, my name is Matt Fernley, editor of Battery Materials Review, and here's all the key news in the world of battery materials this month. Welcome to March's edition of Recharge, the podcast by Battery Materials Review. Before we start this edition, I'd just like to flag our Battery Materials Review yearbook, which is now available for free on our website at batterymaterialsreview.com. Just give us your email address and we'll send you this excellent snapshot of the current state of the battery and the battery raw materials industry. So, lots to talk about this month, and without further ado, I'm delighted to welcome my co-presenter, Cormac O'Lara, MD of Electrios Energy, and we're going to run through some of the key talking points from the last month. Hi, Cormac, how are you doing?
Hello, Matthew. I'm quite well. A little tired from my travelling recently. It's been a while since we...
Bit jet-lagged, back from the US, the big US battery conference, right. And hopefully we're going to hear some insights on that later on.
Yeah, great conference. Yeah, I'll tell you a little bit more about it later.
Okay, great. Let's dive straight in. This month's Battery Materials Review, the focus is very much on EVs and EV sales. I'm not going to sort of say too much about that here, but suffice to say that our EV sales forecast is quite a lot higher than many of the bulge bracket brokers are suggesting, and we go through the three main reasons for that in this month's Battery Materials Review. As we record this, the preliminary data for February sales is just starting to come out. Doesn't seem too bad. Would you agree? I mean, the initial data I've seen suggests January, February together up a little bit year on year.
And the Chinese data, a little bit different. Looks slightly different what we look at. Primarily interested in the BEVs, interested in the whole suite. But on the BEV front, it's a bit funny, actually. I think we discussed it earlier, but it's about the date where Chinese New Year landed. So last January was pretty weak in China. This year, January, a lot stronger. This year's February, because of the date of Chinese New Year, is a lot weaker than last year's. I'm seeing 280,000 BEVs produced as opposed to about 400,000 in February last year.
10 fewer sort of operating days in February than last year. So most China watchers tend to look at January, February combined data because otherwise you're comparing not even apples with cucumbers, maybe apples with dragon fruits, I don't know. But so we tend to look at January, February combined data.
Tough to make a forecast off January's data alone.
And some interesting sort of news in EV land in China. I mean, BYD basically going back and sort of rebranding its fleet with these sort of honor models, I think they are, and reducing the price. I mean, the Seagull now retailing in China for less than $10,000, which is pretty major data point, I think, to get a car of that quality for less than $10,000 a unit is pretty impressive.
You know, it's hard to see which bracket they're falling into. Are they going down into the mini EV bracket, although the Seagull's a bigger car?
Well, the Seagull's a proper car, isn't it? I mean, it's got four seats or five seats, and it's not a mini EV, which is two seats and an engine.
You can get some mini EVs with four seats. But it's a proper car. A lot of people seem to be shocked that cars in China are a lot cheaper than anywhere else in the world, even prior to this move. Just passenger vehicles in general, pretty reasonable and well-priced. But BYD, quite aggressive. You know, they didn't make any indication that they're rolling that model out worldwide anytime soon.
And more's the shame, really. And, you know, I've written a blog this week this week as we record this, just talking a little bit about this and just... really pleading with the European Union in terms of this tariff investigation it's initiated on China and suggesting, look, you know, maybe going for a two-tiered tariff system might be the answer rather than taxing all Chinese vehicles, maybe just tax all Chinese vehicles above a certain price. Because what stands out about the Chinese EV industry is they are still mass market and there are no vehicles in Europe or the US which are mass market. So if we want, you know, the EV event to be successful, we've got to offer mass market vehicles. And at the moment, the only way to offer those is to make them in China and move them to Europe. And I kind of feel that the EU's kind of got this wrong in many ways with some of the rhetoric that's coming out. So be interesting to sort of hear people's reactions to that blog piece. But yeah, my view is very much that rather than going with a blunt one size fits all, let's just tax the hell out of them, maybe go with a two-tier system whereby you don't tax vehicles that are coming to the market for less than 20,000 euros. Because let's face it, you're not competing with any European OEMs if you bring an EV to the market in Europe for less than 20,000 euros.
Yeah, I read the blog. Yeah, interesting way to view it. Yeah, I think makes sense. We're talking about two things here. One is the energy transition, and the other, and you also mentioned the blog, is protecting the European automotive industry. But you know, as you quite rightly point out, there's not really a like for like. Who are you competing against at that price point in the market? And will BMW and Mercedes buyers, consumers to you know, less than 15,000 euro a vehicle? I don't think so. So I think it would be more positive than anything else.
Yeah. Okay, moving on. Samsung SDI, let's talk about that, because obviously released to the market with lots of fireworks and fun and games and a number of questions I've had about this. So Samsung SDI announced that they'll bring a solid state battery into commercial production. I think it was in 27, 28. So still sometime in the future. Interesting sort of takeaways. Only, I think, something like a 40% increase in energy density, which seems a little bit light for a proper solid state battery. Any insight into that?
Yeah. I've been following this one for a while, actually. I was asked questions about this 4 years ago when they first published their paper in the Journal of Nature, or the Nature Journal. It was about their sulfide. So, you know, solid state batteries are essentially broken down if they're all solid state, which is how Samsung detailed their battery back in 2020. So they're sulfides and oxides. This is the sulfide-based electrolyte, which is thought to be the easier of the solid-state electrolytes to mass produce. They had an interesting take on it, where one of the big problems with solid-state batteries, other than conductivity, is lithium dendrite growth. At the time, Samsung released this groundbreaking paper, and they were coating the anode, which is wouldn't be graphite in this case, but the substance where lithium would be plated onto with a silver carbon-based epoxy coating. So now we're seeing the fruits of that. At the time, they had advertised it as 900 watt-hours per liter, which is volumetric energy density. I believe the latest announcement is 800 watt-hours per liter, again, volumetric energy density. Automotive battery industry, we're more accustomed to seeing energy density in watt-hours per kilogram, which I haven't seen for this latest announcement, but there's a debate in the market for a number of years, which is more important, volumetric energy density or mass energy density, watt-hours per kilogram. But the OEM see as volumetric energy density being the most important factor, because it's about how much space the battery occupies in the EV. And so we often see volumetric energy density used by the top-tier OEMs. And I think that's what we're seeing here again with Samsung. So we really don't have an idea what put it like for like with current lithium ion batteries on a watt hour per kilogram energy density basis.
But even, you know, 800 watt hours per liter, that is, it's not blowing the lights out compared to the current generation of ternary batteries, is it? I mean, it's not like, you know, multiples of their energy density.
Yeah. The standard lithium ion batteries can get up to 700 watt hours per liter, actually, depending on the form and the chemistry. But
yeah,
so we're talking at least 500 watt hours per liter on standard lithium ion batteries. So
you don't sit here and go, well, this is amazing, particularly given that they're guiding that it's going to cost three times as much to produce. So you're like sitting there going, well, you get a 40% increase, maybe a 40% increase, maybe less increase in energy density, and it costs three times as much to produce. Why?
Innovation.
Oh, okay. Innovation. I should buy innovation. Okay, great. Yeah, go with that.
Yeah, but you know, it's still, you know, interesting. This started as an academic research endeavor for Samsung, and they're going all the way to commercial. So that's 4 years in. on the first paper. So 2020. So you said 2028, 8 years from paper publishing to mass production. That is, I guess, and now who knows how many years they put in before they published the paper, let's say. So it seems on the timeline for what we commonly thought for solid state electrolytes, about 10 years to from R&D to mass.
You say mass production. I mean, obviously, the big question is, will they get to mass production, given that there is a, you know, competitive cell in the market, which is, you know, a little bit less energy dense, but a lot more economic in terms of, any, you know, dollars per kilowatt hour. So it'd be interesting to see whether they actually make it to mass production or not. Whether mass production or maybe commercial production would be a reasonable.
I think mass production these days is, you know, anything greater than 10 gigawatt hours production. Yeah. Samsung are barely at that in their entire business right now. So it'll be a big endeavor for them to get greater than 10 gigawatt hours by the end of the decade for sure.
Yeah.
Looking at something less than 500 megawatt hours probably.
Okay, let's move on. And well, let's talk about something that's going in the right direction, which is lithium prices, which appear to have, let's say, passed their trough since we last spoke. I think we last spoke at the beginning of February. Prices have moved up quite considerably, actually, since then, bounced very strongly off their trough after Chinese New Year. We've obviously seen lepidolite shutdowns in China. We've seen a little bit of shortage of spodumene concentrate in the system. And we've also seen speculation that cathode makers, Chinese cathode makers, are going to come into the market quite strongly at the beginning of March, much more strongly than we've really seen since really this time last year. A little bit of a fundamental bounce in lithium prices, a lot of a speculative bounce in lithium prices. Going to be interesting to see where they go from here. A lot of numbers being cited by the industry. What are you hearing from your industry contacts? Strong demand or just a little bit of a dead cat bounce?
Actually, yeah, strong demand for lithium chemicals, primarily talking about lithium hydroxide going to Korea and Japan. It's been believed there's going to be a big uptick in lithium hydroxide exports to Korea from March, but we'll see those numbers at the end of the month. But from what I'm hearing on the ground, there's a number of new cathode facilities just opened up in Korea, are opening up by the end. We're almost at the end of Q1, so we're expecting a big uptick in lithium demand in that area. In China, slightly different, of course, again, but anecdotally, I've been reading there's been January, February was one of the biggest import months for lithium carbonate ex-Chile to China. So
yeah, a lot of material came out of Chile in January and February. I think, you know, we're now going to see quite a substantial differentiation between the LFP and the ternary supply chain. As you said, it looks like situation is going to be a little bit tighter in hydroxide. Indeed, we're seeing that in prices at the moment. So we're seeing the carbonate supply chain prices drift off a little bit. I noticed that the fast markets carbonate prices is drifting off, even while the hydroxide price is sort of adding a little bit of momentum. I'm not going to say a large amount of momentum because it ain't, but it's nice to see a little bit of positive momentum after what's been quite a torrid time for the hydroxide supply chain.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there's a bit of a rally coming around the nickel-based chemistries again this year, I envisage. So I think lithium hydroxide, we may see that crossover again this year.
Okay. I mean, that's interesting you should say that, because obviously, the Indonesian government has been out saying, you know, they want to cap the increase in nickel prices. The Australian government's been out trying to support the domestic industry after BHP threatened to close down their Nickel West operation. I think the big question for the auto industry is, do you really want to be exposed to a nickel industry that's 60% controlled by Indonesia and 20% controlled by Russia? Is that really a healthy environment to be exposed to? Because I kind of don't think it is. So, you know, maybe instead of sort of pushing prices down as low as they could go, you might think a little bit about how important it is to keep up a diversified nickel industry rather than sort of being very, very compressed in terms of the supplier base.
Yeah, yeah. They kind of you know, the big theme of the automotive EV in the last 2 years has been diversify supply chains. But yeah, we're not seeing it. It's more of a consolidation around Indonesia now, which is essentially most of those mining operations have Chinese involvement, all of them, more or less. So again, a heavy reliance on Chinese Indonesian, I would describe it as nickel.
Yeah. And I mean, this is one of the themes that we pick up in the yearbook as well, that China has effectively gone almost round the outside in, you know, two of these major materials where they didn't really have a supply base 5 years ago, which is in nickel and lithium. They've sort of outsmarted, if you will, the Western, you know, OEMs. And obviously the auto industry is making hay while the sun shines, while prices are very low, material prices are very low. Going forward, you have to say that there are risks of having supply so concentrated in, as you said, Indonesia / China and Russia.
Indonesia nickel since early 2010s. And how many times have Indonesia turned on and off the nickel exports? I mean,
yeah,
it's not beyond the realm of possibility. You know, they've done it before. Once we are consolidated, the 60% nickel coming from Indonesia, you know, they can turn that on and off and have done anytime they want.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a real risk. And, you know, if the auto industry didn't wake up with the Chinese changes to the graphite export license regime at the end of last year, they'd be foolish not to take note of the large levels of concentration in Indonesia this year. I think it's a real risk for the supply chain that's not really being properly appreciated by the OEMs. And I wouldn't say it's all the OEMs. I mean, we do have OEMs sort of making cash available in Canada and places like that. But more of them need to be more global and not just focused on cheap sort of Indonesian supply, which, let's face it, as again we note in the yearbook, is not always that ESG friendly either. That's all I wanted to say about raw materials. You just got back from the States, Cormac. So what did you learn on your trip there?
Yeah, I was at the International Battery Seminar in Orlando. Wasn't a tough venue to go to, I'll be honest. Staying on Universal Studios.
My heart doesn't bleed for you.
Yeah, beautiful, beautiful weather we had. And yeah, this is the oldest. Ever since my days as a student, I always wanted to go to this one. So I think it's 42 years old now, this one. But it's the oldest battery conference, and one of the most prestigious, really. I wasn't an invited speaker, but in attendance, with some great speakers there. We had the CEO of Panasonic North America discussing their future. They primarily focused in North America. They're building the new 4680 plant in Kentucky. They're planning, I didn't get a chance to ask the question, but they're planning to have 30% of the revenue coming from ESS, but they have no plans for LFP batteries. So I found that interesting, the role for NCA in ESS. Of course, Jeff Dan usually gives the keynote there every year, and he was there again. Quite an interesting talk about the effect of, so, you know, you have a liquid electrolyte floating around your battery, and he was showing how that isn't static. It just doesn't sit there and mediate the system. It's the battery functions like a straw, basically. As you charge and discharge, the electrolyte gets soaked up into the graphite primarily, which expands and pushes the electrolyte around the cell. And what happens is you get areas of, after some time, you get areas where less electrolyte is concentrated, and then leads to the overall deterioration of the battery. So that was a pretty interesting talk about how another way a battery can fail. Again, I wanted to ask him, because he just did show recently that he has 5 million mile batteries functioning in his cell and in his lab for Tesla. So on one hand, he's painting a picture of cells are all going to fail because of electrolyte. On the other hand, he's got 5 million mile battery. So that was pretty good. And of course, I met some listeners of the show, and we got some very nice feedback from them. It's always nice, actually, these days when I go to conferences. I'm sure same as you, Matt, where we meet listeners in the show and great feedback. So appreciate all the listeners out there.
Anything on sort of any of the other company? Any interesting techs out there?
So the theme, I would say, as a theme. So a lot of talks about silicon, primarily silicon now, and that brings you back to the scare that the whole globe got when China introduced the graphite export licenses. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say bans, licenses.
Yeah, licenses, not bans. Never bans.
Lot there on silicon. The theme I picked up was it wasn't about revolutionary silicon, it was how we can make it work. I got the latest tech and it's going to work straight. It was like, we have some problems, but we can make it work by building out the system, including other materials, say polymers, which would help with silicon expansion. So more solutions than innovative tech, I sound. So we know what the materials we need are. How do we actually successfully integrate them? And that's what I saw a lot of the talks were about, which are a bit more realistic on chances of these materials working on a large level. So
there's a lot of companies in the US doing research on silicon, aren't there? I mean, there always have been. There's some really interesting sort of, there's Silicon Nanotech, and is it One World? There's guys doing serious research on silicon anodes in the US.
Correct, yeah.
More so than in other regions, I think.
US historically, they have Innovate, they have Silinano, they have Amprius. Yeah, they have a long, I did all my research in US. Most of the battery technology started out of the Department of Energy, US. That is the R&D, not the commercialization. Yeah, that's why the oldest battery show is in the US. It's because at that time, more of the battery innovation was being done in the US and still is really. On the R&D side, not the commercialization, which was primarily China these days.
Yeah. Okay. And any sort of interesting sort of feedback on ESS and sort of that side of the business? Because obviously that has been a bit slower.
I had a couple of discussions about it. I'm beginning to think we just should call this E, because I don't see a lot on the S&G side of, ESG. Sorry, I was ready for the ESG question, Matt. Sorry. ESS. Not a lot of discussions on ESS. This is more automotive focus, really.
Okay. Fine. Talk a little bit more about E, or as it's also known, ESG. What are you hearing on that side of things?
Well, again, you just alluded to the big concern again is on the nickel production, and that's just the E. No one's really talking about the S and G side of it, just the E alone. So I think when companies in the battery sector refer to ESG, they don't consider the S and G part at all. It's just the E from what I can see. So I would like them to amend their slides, because it's all about the carbon footprint.
And indeed, the International Lithium Association just, I think it was last week actually, has come out with carbon intensity guidance. It's the first time that anybody's ever come out with anything like that. So, I think the industry is looking hard at carbon intensity. But of course, carbon intensity is not the only thing. I mean, I did kind of ask the International Lithium Association, I assume that they were being sponsored by a brine producer, because a number of brine producers have banged up hard rock producers in recent years, highlighting the higher carbon intensity, of course, ignoring the very high freshwater intensity of brine production. We won't go into that. But as you said, there are other aspects of the ESG that I kind of feel that the industry is not really promoting to the extent it should be.
And I love using the words, but they're definitely not looking at there's a lot more to it. Yeah. But interesting enough, though, Panasonic, during their talk, was showing that only 14% of their carbon exposure, the carbon footprint of the whole process, comes from their actual production, their gigafactories, and the rest is from the supply chain, which
really, that's
very difficult for them to lean on the suppliers to clean up a little bit, they were saying. So
yeah, but I mean, that makes sense, because obviously they are primarily an NCA and a ternary producer, and if you don't produce your nickel in sort of Canada or in Finland or whatever with pretty clean power, then you are relying on either H power production in Indonesia, or even worse, RKEF production in Indonesia, which is between 5 and 20 times more carbon intensive. Yeah, I mean, I think it's really incumbent on the cell manufacturers and the OEMs to police their supply chain a little bit more. And we're really not seeing that to the extent that we need to be seeing it. And obviously the question that I always get asked, and be quite interested to hear your point of view on this, is, well, how about the two-tiered pricing structure? Are we ever going to get OEMs and cell manufacturers being prepared to pay more for a less carbon-intensive raw material product? What do you think?
I can tell you from the recycling side, there's zero appetite to pay more for recycled metals than pristine right now. Doesn't look like it's going to come across anytime soon. So quite interesting that there'd be a lot of nickel moved around in the market in terms of traceability, but very tough to enforce that, I can see. And there seems to be very little appetite for it in the market right now.
So. Yeah, I would agree. That's the answer I always give. It feels very much like the automakers and the cell makers are really paying lip service to ESG at the moment. They're happy to make sort of easy changes, but they're not really doing anything that serious about promoting sort of ESG, even the E in ESG. So wonders.
I heard recently that a major OEM only becomes interested in the ESG part towards the end of the year when their sustainability report is due. So I was quite surprised to hear that. It didn't seem to be an all year round interest.
Yeah, you would think so, wouldn't you? You would think so. Yeah. Excellent. Okay. Anything else exciting from you for this month?
Exciting. No, I've been traveling for 3 weeks straight. Just came back yesterday. You wanted me on the podcast 30 minutes after I landed. Luckily, we managed to move it on. So I'm getting a little break. Then I'm off to Korea for fast markets. So looking forward to that.
I should highlight that both Cormac and myself are intending to be at the Fast Markets Conference in Las Vegas in June. One of the few times that we actually see each other in person during the year. So if you're going to that conference, please feel free to come over and reach out to us.
Yep,
you won't probably recognize us apart from our voices, but, fingers crossed.
Yeah. Apologies. I didn't get you in London 2 weeks ago. That was tight as well. But yeah, I'll definitely see you in Vegas.
Yeah. Okay. Brilliant. I will say thanks very much to Cormac and look forward to speaking to you better rested next month.
Yeah. Great.
Thanks a lot.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
So that brings us to the end of our podcast for March. As always, you can get more detail on all of the topics we've discussed, and indeed many more that we don't have time to discuss on a monthly basis, in the latest issue of Battery Materials Review, which you can find at www.batterymaterialsreview.com. And also don't forget to check out our excellent free yearbook at the same address. I'm Matt Fernley, editor of Battery Materials Review, and this has been Recharge. Thanks for listening.